Coming up on Hear Me Out, he was a boy from Poplar who became America's top aviator with a World War II record of enemy planes shot down that still stands today.
Up in the midnight blue.
But even though we've all been over the bridge named for him, who was Richard Vaughn?
This is Frank McCarthy, United Press reporting from an advanced Allied base in New Guinea. I'm alive to tell you the story of my 45-minute flight with America's new ace of aces, Major Richard Ira Vaughn.
He had seen the new jet when he was back after breaking Rickenbacker's record, and he knew he had to fly that plane.
I'm Robin Washington. Join us for this special Memorial Day weekend rebroadcast of Forever Ace, the Richard Vaughn story, after this.
Racing with the moon. That is what I'll always do. Racing with the moon. High up in the midnight blue.
Hello, I'm Jim Packard. Between December 1942 and December 1944, U.S. Army Air Corps fighter pilot Richard Vaughn shot down 40 enemy aircraft, more than any American pilot in World War II or any United States conflict. This is his story as told by his family, friends, and colleagues. There was nothing that would portend national hero in Richard Ira Vaughn, but there was a lot that made him a good guy and a popular kid. That's the way Marvin Peterson sees it. He was Vaughn's best friend growing up in Poplar. No one figured he'd be a war hero someday.
Well, not back in those days, of course. We were just strictly small-town people, and whatever he did try to do well.
Peterson and Dick Vaughn went to the same church, the same 4-H club, the same school, and to the state teacher's college in nearby Superior. He says his buddy liked to play baseball, sang in the church choir, and played the cornet. But mostly, someday he wanted to fly.
He was interested in building model airplanes and that type of thing. Any flying was a big event back in those days. It was not the common thing that we think of today. And any time an airplane came near a town, why, it was quite an event. If it sometimes it landed in a hayfield out in back of our school, and sometimes just went over, but it was a big event.
Dick Vaughn was 7 years old when President Calvin Coolidge made Superior, Wisconsin, the summer White House in 1928. Coolidge liked to fish, and the world-renowned Brule River, loaded with brown and brook trout, was less than an hour from Superior. Vaughn's younger sisters, Jerry and Joyce, he had six sisters and two brothers, remember that twice a day a plane would fly over the Vaughn family farm, carrying mail and official correspondence for the president.
When we were out there playing, all of a sudden here'd come this plane overhead. And of course, everybody, you didn't see an airplane very often, so everybody would ran yelling, "Airplane, airplane," because everybody got so excited when they saw one. And that was his plane that we saw, and that was...
And we run out every time yet and look at the airplane, you run out.
Planes were pretty exotic down on the farm. Sister Joyce Vaughn Erickson says farm life was demanding. Dick helped his dad, Carl, tend to the crops and took care of the cows and hogs.
Dick and Bud would have to take care of the barn work. I just remember school days. Dinelda would be washing the dishes, and maybe Jerry, well, you would make the lunches
made the
all the time.
Lunches.
School lunches.
Uh-huh.
So Nelda's the oldest. We would, you know, she would be washing the dishes. And, of course, we younger ones, you know, had to wipe dishes and things like that. Of course, we had to get our beds made before we went to school and so on. So, of course, you got home from school, and there were beans to pick or potatoes to pick, or there was always something to do, work to be done. Yeah.
Speaking in a 2004 interview in the same farmhouse where she grew up, Joyce and Sister Jerry sat in the living room just downstairs from the bedroom where Dick shared a bed with Brother Bud. Surrounded by family pictures, Jerry said the hard work and devotion necessary to life on a family farm shaped Dick Vaughn.
Everybody worked hard on the farm. There's no doubt. We all had our own jobs to do, and we learned what's right from wrong.
It was his job to do, I guess, so he did it.
But after the chores were done, Jerry says her brother's attention turned to aviation.
He and his friend Roger Robinson used to spend a lot of time here making those little paper airplanes, you know, they had used balsa wood. And they used a razor blade, and they cut these little tiny pieces out, and then they glued them together. And then they put, like, tissue paper to fill in the skin over the plane. Then they used rubber binders to twist the prop up, and they'd go out in the yard to fly them, and they might fly once, and they'd crash, and they'd have to start over again and see if they could pierce them up, but they did that a lot, and some of their planes were with wingspans about, like, 2 feet at long, probably more than that, some of them.
The boy who built balsa wood model planes and chased the president's mail plane with his barking dog Speaks had a lofty goal, to fly. In 1941, he enlisted in the Army Air Corps Aviation Cadet Program. Joyce Bong Erickson said, while it was a way to serve his country, he wasn't trying to be particularly noble.
I don't know about the patriotic duty. I don't think any of the kids were really thinking that because they weren't in war yet. He just figured this could happen, and something that if he wanted to be where he wanted to be, he had to do it that way.
The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and airfields at Ford Island, Hickam, Bellows, and Wheeler were the explosive culmination of long simmering tensions between the United States and Japan. 7 of 8 U.S. battleships were sunk in what President Franklin Roosevelt called a date which will live in infamy. Colonel Mark Wells is the chairman of the U.S. Air Force Academy's History Department.
We underestimated the Japanese. To be very direct, there was an element of racism. We thought that these were Japanese, after all, and somehow that we would prevail rather more easily. And yet, the Japanese pretty much ran wild for 6 months or so in the Pacific, took a whole series of islands and extended this perimeter way out. Wake Island fell, the Philippines fell, Bataan and Corregidor. It was just one American and Allied defeat after another. The British in Malaya and Singapore fell, and Australia threatened. So we quickly began to understand that this was no easy enemy to overcome. They quickly dissuaded us of any sort of racist notions that they were inferior. So the Japanese gave us everything we could handle for the first 6 months, and the road back would be very long.
Along with crippled naval power, Wells says American air power in the Pacific was hit hard. He says the Japanese had better planes and better pilots.
Japanese pilots had been flying and fighting in China. They were extraordinarily elite, with thousands of flying hours. They're called the Sea Eagles, and these guys were virtuosos. And, of course, you've heard about Japanese Zeros and the excellence of that airplane. And our airplanes were, even by the start of the war in the Pacific, relatively obsolete. The Brewster Buffalo and the Grumman F-4F Wildcat was slightly better. The P-40s of Flying Tiger fame in China were inferior and had to be skillfully used to keep from being shot down. Anyway, our pilots got better and better, sort of the crucible of combat, and as the training programs in the United States ramped up and we were able to send people to the South Pacific, then they got better.
In the days that followed the attacks on Hawaii and Southeast Asia, the Japanese fears expanded quickly, closing in on Australia. Australian War Museum historian Dr. Carl James says the low point was an air raid on Darwin in early 1942.
There was certainly some fear, and a justifiable fear and concern in a lot of quarters. A lot of resolve as well. The Australian population, the Australian industry and home front were mobilized for war in a way which we'd never been mobilized before.
James says Australia braced for a Japanese attack by building makeshift airfields in the jungle in early 1942 as the first American soldiers, pilots, and sailors arrived. Just as the British would say as U.S. forces built up for the invasion of Europe from Great Britain, Aussie diggers thought GIs were overpaid, oversexed, and overhere. But James says Allied air and naval power joining with Australian forces were pivotal in holding off a Japanese juggernaut that seemed unstoppable as it overran neighboring New Guinea and New Britain. James says the GIs and diggers had more to deal with than Japanese Zeros. They had to fight the jungles of Australia and New Guinea.
I'm sure it's all matter of snakes, creatures, and insects that my senior servicemen from Midwest would not be used to at all.
In May 1942 came the fierce naval and air battle of the Coral Sea.
It's notable for two reasons. One is the first time you have two substantial surface fleets who actually don't sight each other. All the combat is conducted by carrier-borne aviation. The losses pretty much even, we say, on either side. We lost a carrier, the Japanese lost a light carrier, but strategically the Japanese, they were worried enough that they didn't continue south towards Australia, so that's why Coral Sea is important.
Then came the Battle of the Midway Islands on June 4th.
if Midway didn't hold, the nearest U.S. base would be pushed back to Pearl Harbor.
Up to Midway, the Japanese are on the offensive almost everywhere. We're scrambling to try to stop them. Midway stopped their advance.
In August, the Battle of Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands was the first Allied offensive in the South Pacific. The battle raged for months and set the stage for the island-hopping march northward. Wells says small, unknown atolls became key airstrips so fighters and bomber pilots could assault Japanese ground troops and ships. Wells said the strategy was to advance the bomber line. Dick Bong began in the Air Corps as a flying cadet in early 1941. Stateside training lasted more than a year. Chomping at the bit to see some action, he was shipped out from Hamilton Field near San Francisco to a jungle airdrome outside of Port Moresby, New Guinea, in the fall of 1942. The job of the 39th Squadron was to patrol and harass the enemy as the Japanese tried to reinforce its bases in the Bunagona area near Port Moresby. Bong's crew chief was Elwood Barden, a southern boy from Alabama. They were both 22 years old, green, and hoping for action.
When he first came on my plane, I was probably an old man about, I might have been 22. I know I was 21 when the Japanese gave me a birthday present. They sent over about 27 Betty bombers. That was my birthday present. But anyhow, he just looked like a baby kid when he come and got in that airplane.
After several uneventful patrols, Second Lieutenant Bong got his wish to see action. On December 27, 1942, Captain Tommy Lynch led a patrol of four P-38s with Bong as his wingman. They were told that 40 enemy planes were in the Buna area. More P-38s were dispatched, but Lynch led his group into what Bong described as a screaming dive into the formation of Zeros and bombers. In his book, America's Ace of Aces, The Dick Bong Story, Carl Bong writes that a Zero was on his brother's tail, so he dove his P-38 to what Dick Bong described as 2 inches above the shortest tree in the Buna area. As he leveled off, an Imperial dive bomber was in front of him. He gave a short burst from his 50-caliber guns and said the bomber blew higher than a kite. Then out of the corner of his eye, he saw a Zero coming into his line of fire. Another burst, and the Zero expired in the middle of his sights. On December 27, 1942, Bong got his first 2 kills. In 2 weeks, he'd shoot down 3 more, giving him the minimum number of kills to become an American ace. It wasn't easy being crew chief for a fighter pilot in the South Pacific jungles. Sergeant Elwood Barden of Mobile, Alabama, was crew chief for Bong in Dobadura, New Guinea.
You had to do a lot of things over there that over here you could just get parts and change them. Over there we had to take parts and work them and put them back together and get them going like that, especially in the hydraulic systems of the planes. It took lots of long hours. I mean, we worked round the clock, if necessary, to keep them going. One time he came in, you know, the crew chiefs always jumped up on the airplane, wanted to know if they made contact or anything like that. So I jumped up there on the wing and said, "Well, Major, did you do anything?" He said, "Yeah, I think I got 4, but says, you might better check my tail section back there. I think I got hit." I went back there on the left side of that boom, and the ailerons was almost shot off.
Barton said each fighter pilot had a ground crew that kept the engine running, the radio working, and the guns firing. There was even a sheet metal guy who plugged the bullet holes. 1942 and 1943 were the most dangerous years. Ralph Wandry was Bong's wingman. In a 2003 interview, Dobadura was still fresh in Wandry's memory. A grass strip 10,000 feet long on Buna Plantation, the only flatland for miles. It was between a 13,000-foot-high mountain range and the jungle.
Behind us was a swamp and a rainforest, which our camp was located in. This was about, 12 miles deep. And it was inhabited by 20-foot crocodiles and 22 and longer foot pythons. Not a good place to go down. And on the right was the Pacific Ocean. 2 miles ahead of our airplanes where we parked them were the front lines. I spent the first 4 months, we didn't fly an offensive mission. We just tried to keep the Japanese from blowing us off the face of the earth. This was Dobadura.
Bong's fame grew, shooting down 21 Zeros, Oscars, Zeke's, Betty's, and Dinah's, the masculine names for fighter planes, the feminine names for bombers. Wandry says stories grew taller, including one that Bong killed a crocodile to save a fellow pilot who crash-landed.
We lost a pilot in the swamp behind the deal, and he could hear the airplanes warm up every morning. He was hanging in a parachute. It took 3 days for the Australians to get in there and rescue him with rubber rafts. And as they were coming out, there was a 20-foot crocodile following the raft. Bong was circling there, and he was going to strafe the crocodile. And wisely, he decided, well, if any of these bullets ricochet and sink the raft, we're not going to do any good or anything. But he kept going until they got out of the way and lost the croc. But that's one of the deals that didn't happen, but it made a good story, and they built it up in the magazine that they put out then.
Army Air Corps pilot Walter Markey met Bong at a tactical training unit in San Francisco in August 1942. Their mission was to defend the city against a Japanese air attack, but that mission changed. Markey and Bong were among a dozen pilots who were ordered to Australia and fly P-38 Lightning fighter planes to support ships and bombers. Markey says those early days were marked by short supplies and rations that weren't very good eating.
What support we could build up on the home front went to Europe. The troops in Australia and New Guinea just had to make do with what had to fight a holding battle is basically what all was being looked for at that point in time.
Markey and Bong were tent mates. They were assigned to airstrips in Australia, then to the northern coast of New Guinea and the Schwimmer Aerodrome, and then Dobadura. He says their planes were the only thing keeping Japanese troops from resuming attacks on Australia.
The Owen Stanley, the mountain range that ran down the spine of New Guinea, was their impediment to being able to go any further. If they got the other coast of New Guinea, why, they would have had a jumping-off point for Australia.
Markey says in their first few months, they flew defensive missions over places a popular farm boy or a Brooklyn tough guy like him never heard of. The Huon Gulf, Milne Bay, Banya Banya, New Guinea, and the Bismarck Sea.
So we didn't have that much engagement at all times with Japanese aircraft. On a few occasions, half dozen maybe, they came over on bombing missions, and there'd be an engagement. In the latter stages of 43, we would go on to aggressive missions on Rabaul or Wewak. We had become engaged with Japanese protective forces. But other than a monthly strike by Washing Machine Charlie that came over in the full moon and dropped a stick of bombs on New Guinea, why, they didn't have any sustained effort.
This is Forever Ace.
I'm gonna buy a paper doll that I can call my own.
On November 17th, 1943, only days from the jungles of the Southwest Pacific, Captain Richard Bong was home in northern Wisconsin, arriving late at night on the heels of a winter storm. Sisters Jerry and Joyce remember the farmhouse was packed.
Oh, my. How many were here from the college themselves? How many professors?
Air cadets were stationed in Superior going to college, and they had a band. They were here in the house. I don't know how many pieces there were. 15, 20
no,
or whatever.
There were a lot of them, yeah. I would say
and then there 15, were representatives from the Legion and from the vets and from the newspapers and all of us. And I don't know how many there were. I would suppose 50, 60 people anyhow.
There were a lot of people.
With 21 enemy kills to his credit in less than a year of combat, Captain Bong was one of America's top three aces, along with Marine pilots Smokey Joe Foss and Pappy Boyington. So everyone wanted a piece of the new war hero, their war hero. He had become a national symbol to a nation in need of heroes. Reporters and photographers vied for stories and pictures. Local dignitaries wanted him to make speeches and be at their head table. There was even a local Boots for Bong drive to get him a pair of winter boots so he could go hunting. Since rubber was rationed, it nearly took an act of Congress to get the boots. Northern Wisconsin Congressman Alvin O.K. Okonski delivered. Bong got his boots. Amidst the hubbub, a group of co-eds from Superior State wanted him to crown the king and queen at their homecoming dance. Mary Gray was one of a group of six Lambda Sigma Lambda sorority sisters hoping to land the big catch. In fact, Gray and her pals were themselves quite a catch.
I'm trying to think what it was called, and we didn't call it that, really. But someone just in fun mentioned it one time in our group, you know, scintillating six. So you can see why we didn't say it about ourselves.
Scintillating was a bit racy for 1943 northern Wisconsin. Still, Gray and reigning homecoming queen Marjorie Vattendall reeled in their hero. Vattendall said Dick Bong promised to be at the dance.
When he walked into the gymnasium where the thing was taking place, you could just hear, I called it like the buzzing of blue flies, you could just hear this murmur. You know, there he is, there he is.
Vattendall says the plan was for Bong to crown the king, and she would pass on her crown to the queen.
He didn't seem to be listening to me at all, you know. I was getting a little annoyed because, I mean, he was so happy to be home, you know, to be surrounded by his family and friends. He and Pete were poking each other, you know, and acting like real troublemakers as far as I was concerned. Well, come the time for him to do it, he did everything that he was supposed to do, and I was so nervous. I just flubbed everything, but it was fun.
Not only was Bong a war hero, but at 23 years old, he was a college-age man. Both were rare on the home front during the war years. But the problem was, he wouldn't dance. So effortless and graceful in the sky, the earthbound Bong had never learned to dance. Vattendall figured that was that. Even a member of the scintillating six couldn't get the fearless fighter ace to give dancing a try. But in fact, the story was only beginning. After the dance, Vattendall and her friend Margie Flynn went to Chef's Restaurant for ice cream. So did Dick Bong.
It was crowded, and from a back booth, Richard had spotted us. Because I'm so tall, I always stand over everybody, so I was not hard to pick up. So he waved like this, and Margie and I dashed over there and sat down. We talked about that evening's event. Meanwhile, people are coming up and asking for his autograph.
While he didn't like the attention, he did like the company. So did she.
Because he, like so many of the fellows there, were just, his words, just doing our job so they could get home. He was a very skilled pilot. You know, he had great vision, and he just did his job under extreme perilous conditions. When you read about what he did, flying straight into a plane, firing, you know, when you think of that, it gives you goosebumps.
Did you think it would be that way, that night, that something really clicked between you two?
Who can tell something like that? I mean, I was immediately attracted to him because he was really two sides to him. With the press, he was always yes, no, I don't want to talk about that. But among his friends, he was very relaxed, has a wonderful sense of humor, loved to sing. Besides that, he was just darn cute.
For the rest of his leave, Dick and Marge were an item. She says they went to a lot of movies and just spent time together.
I learned how to bowl. It was a complete fiasco because half of the time I would drop the ball and back. And when I finally got it going down, it was more than one gutter ball, I can tell you that. But he taught me how to throw a curveball. And I really got pretty good at it. In fact, I think I beat him in a couple of games, which was something quite wonderful.
How did he take that?
Oh, well, maybe he made it happen. I don't know.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I got a gal.
Bong went to Washington, raised money for war bonds, and returned to a send-off parade in Superior. By February 1944, he was shipped off once more to the Southwest Pacific Theater and the 5th Air Force.
I'm glad to be going back into action again. I always did like shooting birds, and there isn't much different in shooting buzzards, except that these buzzards shoot back.
P-38s were more common in the Pacific War because they performed better in warmer weather. Jack Jacobson flew 111 combat missions beginning in Guadalcanal in 1942 until taking part in the mission to kill Imperial Japanese Commander Yamamoto in 1943. He says the P-38 was fast with a top speed of 400 miles per hour and could almost skim the ocean waves or the jungle tops to evade detection. But most of all, Jacobson says it was a lethal flying machine. United States Air Force Academy History Department Chairman Mark Wells says the twin-engine P-38 was a revolutionary machine with self-sealing fuel tanks and cockpit armor.
That had long range and lots of firepower. And great speed. It wasn't as maneuverable as any of the Japanese airplanes, particularly the Zero, but perfectly adaptable to the Pacific and saw lots and lots and lots of action. Pilots tend to fall in love with the machine that they're flying, unless it's just a complete dog. I mean, the P-38 guys thought it was a magnificent airplane. Yeah, they were in love. And of course, you see, you know, the names on the side, the young ladies in various stages of dress or undress. And I mean, it's quite colorful. Nose art and the psychology of fighter pilots is a whole topic unto itself.
It took cerebral agility and talent to fly these planes, but Colonel Wells says not all fighter pilots were elite. He did a dissertation on World War II pilots, and one he thought said it best. There were a lot of pilots who flew fighters, but only a few were fighter pilots.
He was talking about this combination of aggressiveness without being reckless. I don't know that any of them that I talked to were bloodthirsty at all, but there was a sense of competition and keenness. Some of them had a real boyish thrill for flying. I mean, kind of the kinetic thrill of just being in control of things. They're very, very quick in terms of mental quickness without necessarily being, you know, a PhD or a genius.
Wells says Imperial Japanese Navy fighter pilots were also a special breed.
The one that almost immediately comes to mind is by a man by the name of Saburo Sakai. And he actually, you know, was in it from the beginning and survived the war, astonishingly enough. To say that these guys were elite is an understatement, particularly the pre-war guys. He describes pre-war training in the extreme, maybe 10 out of 100 who sign up actually getting through the whole regime, but going up, being ordered to go up to a cliff and jump. If they hesitated, they washed out. I mean, just the most severe kind of training. And then they were flying great equipment, the Zero, long range, and they had doctrine and they had experience and they gave us all we could handle.
Imperial Japanese Navy pilot Saburo Sakai was born into a family with samurai ancestry and was the second leading Japanese ace to survive the war. He finished with 60 Allied planes destroyed or damaged, most of them American. His motto was, never give up. Yet he said glorifying war was wrong and became a Buddhist monk after the war. Wells says most fighter pilots didn't shoot down any enemy planes, with 5 to 10% of the group accounting for 50% of the kills in World War II. So the few like Richard Bong, Tommy McGuire, David McCampbell, Gregory Boyington, and Aussie ace Clive Killer Caldwell, who, by the way, hated his nickname, were unique.
So you have a combination of traits that I'm quite sure the Air Force would like to identify and bottle and pass out to everybody.
Richard Bong wasn't the Hollywood notion of an ace fighter pilot. Fellow pilot Walter Markey says he wasn't the swashbuckling, hard-drinking type.
I remember in one instance where he was trying to live up to the fighter pilot image. He took a shot of whatever it was, whether it was gin or vodka or whatever. How can anybody drink this stuff? almost joked. Being the sophisticated New Yorker I was at the time, he was a country boy. But he was a nice guy, good friend.
Markey says his friend was honest and always true to his word, and he was determined to end the war as soon as possible.
I was on a mission with him. He was leading the flight. We were escorting B-25s over on New Britain. He took the whole formation, told them not to drop their tanks, turned our whole formation, because above the B-25s we were escorting and below us, a Japanese twin-engine transport-type plane was flying. He turned our whole formation on around. He shot one engine out, shot the other engine out, turned the our formation around, and we caught up with the B-25s. You know, that's the kind of guy he was. So he took advantage of every situation he could. He wasn't a reckless individual.
He says they all came back from missions with bullet holes in their fuselage. Markey says the sound of getting hit was unforgettable.
If you didn't get too many, it was just like a ting, 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 ting. And you turned around, you saw somebody firing at you.
And then what did you do?
Duck.
Staying alive was a day-to-day goal. Wingman Iron Pants Wandry says air combat was fast and intense, but they knew what they had to do and how to do it.
In World War II, a head-on pass was the equivalent of the ultimate game of chicken. The first pilot that turned away was dead. You're coming head-on at someone, he's coming at you. The first one that turns away turns their guns away from that opponent and exposes your belly. You're dead. And I mean literally, this game of chicken was for keeps. I found out that it's a lot more thrilling than a thrill you could do without to watch bullet holes coming up the wing of your plane toward the cockpit.
Back in action, Bong shot down four more enemy planes in 2 weeks. He was just one shy of World War I American ace Eddie Rickenbacker's all-time record of 26. Then on April 3, 1944, during a mission over Hollandia, New Guinea, he tied the record. He broke it 9 days later, shooting down three Japanese Oscar fighter planes and damaging two others over Hollandia. Along with Markey and Wandry, Bong's fighter group, dubbed the Flying Circus, had another leading American ace. Captain Tommy Lynch had 20 kills to his credit. Wandry says Bong needed luck and skill to bag that many enemy aircraft.
When Dick saw an airplane, an enemy plane, he was just like a hound dog on the trail of a rabbit. The rest of the world was gone until he got that plane. Flying on somebody's wing like that, there wasn't a lot left to shoot at when he finished.
The war took its toll on the Flying Circus. On March 8th, Captain Tommy Lynch got his 20th kill, but it cost him his life.
This is Frank McCarthy, United Press reporting from an advanced Allied base in New Guinea. I'm alive to tell you the story of my 45-minute flight with America's new ace of aces, Major Richard Ira Bond. With my knees propped up around my chin and my heart in my throat, I rode piggyback Friday in the P-38 Iron Steed. It was the most unforgettable 45 minutes of my life. While zooming his twin-engine fighter in the cloudless sky, he gave me just one direction. Hang on to your teeth. Indeed, I did hang on with every square inch of skin, while the Major pointed the nose upward in a steep climb and then, I suspect for my benefit, whipped her into a dive. Ostensibly, he told me this was what it was like in aerial combat. We went up, we went down, we executed innumerable immolments and barrel rolls, plus one or two old-fashioned loop-de-loops. Much to my horror, he took his hand off the stick and lit a cigarette. After repeated protestations on my part, the good Major restarted the engine. He then asked if I had blacked out during any of these drills. I replied I hadn't, but I rather enjoyed having my insides pulled apart during the aerial acrobatics. Major Bong then casually remarked that he had blacked out several times during the flight. He commented that he is very prone to blacking out. Even when blacked out, he says his hands know what to do. This pleasure flight was Bong's first since he was grounded after setting the record. If he's sent home, and every indication is that he will be, he says he'd like to fly a P-38 over Poplar and buzz its main street at 400 miles an hour. This correspondent's advice is to people back in America. Hold on to your filly. At an advanced Allied base in New Guinea, this is Frank McCarthy reporting.
And so, Major Bong, in spite of your desire to fly an attack bomber, you were assigned to a fighter.
Yes, Mr. Huntley.
Later, I got my overseas assignment and headed for Australia, and from there to New Guinea for my first mission. Well, that's the story, and of course, I was there.
From Poplar, Wisconsin, comes America's own Major Richard Bong.
Welcome to Furlough Fun, Major. Needless to say, it's a real honor to play host to a top Allied ace of the Pacific.
Burl, I'd rather you'd forget that ace business. I'm just an average American guy who was taught to fly fast and try to shoot straight. Get us the plane. Lots of planes, America. And God willing, we'll fly the wings off them for you. Good night, all.
On December 12, 1944, at Lady Island in the Philippines, Allied Pacific Theater Commander General Douglas MacArthur pinned the Congressional Medal of Honor on Major Bong. In fewer than 3 months of combat missions in the Philippines, he destroyed a dozen more enemy planes, bringing his total to 40, the most of any U.S. pilot. Richard Bong was home for good in January 1945. He was ordered home for his own safety, but not necessarily comfort. He had to do what he hated most. War bond drives demanded that he be in the limelight, and worst of all, he had to give radio interviews. Retired Bong Heritage Museum director Christabel Grant says he walked into a beehive of media.
It was very challenging, and Dick undertook to do it because he felt it was part of the job, that the country needed somebody like him to look up to and to say, yes, I'm out there on the front line fighting and defending our country every single day, and we're all taking these huge risks. And I think he just understood that that needed to be said.
Grant says it was difficult for both Bong and his new fiancée, Marjorie Vattendall. Neither wanted the spotlight, but they were in it. In a 2002 interview, Marjorie Bong Drucker says he was as famous as 1940s movie stars Jimmy Stewart and Clark Gable.
We'd go to the chefs or someplace like that. You could just see people, you know, looking and... And they'd come and get brave enough to come over and talk and so forth. It was fun.
Christabel Grant became good friends with Marjorie Bong Drucker in 1996. The two remained close until her passing in 2003. She says it wasn't the ace pilot who was glamorous, it was Marjorie.
I can only say that any man worth his salt would have singled her out. She was a beautiful young woman, as you can tell from looking at the picture of her he put on the nose of his plane.
That famous picture on Bong's P-38 Lightning wasn't enough for paparazzi. Marjorie Bong Drucker says once they became engaged during a brief leave in 1944, news photographers couldn't get enough of her. They traveled to her home in Superior to shoot America's ace girlfriend to prove she was what turned out to be the mythical all-American woman.
One picture that I always remember, my mother and I with an open oven door, and I'm taking out this roll of beautiful buns that supposedly I had made. Well, I never knew how to. My mother was a wonderful cook and a baker. I tried my darndest to make it smooth on the top. I never did it. Well, I never disclaimed the fact that it was my mother who did that. And then they would come in and they would take pictures of me playing the piano. Well, I didn't play the piano.
Once he was home for good in 1945, the couple wanted to get married right away. But Marjorie says what they wanted didn't matter. The wedding of America's leading ace pilot was a news event too valuable not to exploit. So instead of a January wedding, they would have to wait a couple more weeks. At Concordia Lutheran Church in Superior, on February 10, 1945, they were married and married. And married.
Unbelievable. We didn't have a thing to do with it. I mean, everything was planned, you know, down to the 1,200 people that were invited. Anderson's Bakery over in Duluth made this 8-foot wedding cake. And, well, we did the wedding ceremony actually about 4 times because we only allowed 1 wire service to be there. After that was done, we came back. I think we dashed off to have our wedding pictures done and made a short stop at a WLS barn dance. I mean, we did a telephone thing with that. Then we came back, and they had to let all of the other news publications and wire services come in. And we had to do the ceremony three or four times, and mainly because I flubbed.
You boys that are still overseas, I hope that you can all come home soon to as nice a feeling as I have here now. Every one of you deserves it, and I hope you find it.
Although the war still raged in Europe and the Pacific, it was clear Allied forces would soon prevail. Many veterans of the early dark days of this world war were called home. Major Richard Bong was one of them. Sisters Jerry and Joyce say for the first time since 1941, their parents could breathe a sigh of relief.
I think so. I think Mom was real glad when he was finally coming home to stay.
But at the same time, he had seen the new jet when he was back after breaking Rickenbacker's record, and he knew he had to fly that plane. And so,
his great desire to fly was the reason Bong joined the Army Air Corps. His war service didn't end that desire, so he volunteered to test the newest technology in the air, fighter jets. Carl Bong writes in his book, Ace of Aces, that his brother was looking forward to being a test pilot of the revolutionary P-80 Shooting Star, which would take the Air Force and the United States into the jet age. But the Lockheed aircraft was plagued with design problems. It had crashed more than a dozen times, killing several pilots since it began flying the previous September. In June 1945, he was transferred to the Lockheed base in Burbank. He flew 11 test flights, totaling more than 4 hours. On August 6th, just 4 days after another pilot was killed testing the Shooting Star, the 24-year-old Bong was about to take another flight. The night before, he told friends at a dinner party that he never worried about such things as crashes. He had written his old wingman Ralph Wandry about coming to Burbank and flying these jet fighters. So Wandry transferred from Perrin Air Force Base in Texas and headed west to Burbank.
Just as I was finishing saying goodbye to my buddies at Perrin Field, the news came over the radio that Dick had been killed.
August 6, 1945, was the day the B-29 bomber Enola Gay left the Pacific Island Air Base on Tinian and dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Little Boy, the first atomic weapon used in war, killed about 80,000 people instantly. The secret weapon attracted front-page news, but in many cases it was below the headline of the death of U.S. Ace of Aces Richard Bong. In Ace of Aces, Carl Bong wrote that shortly after noon on August 6th, his brother took off in a P-80 Shooting Star. The takeoff was normal, but moments later, puffs of black smoke were seen coming out of the tailpipe. A Lockheed mechanic watched the right wing tip when the Shooting Star was about 400 feet in the air. Mrs. George Zane watched as the malfunctioning jet headed toward her house. She watched Major Bong try to escape, one wing dipping followed by the other. She said he was fighting with the plane, first flying over telephone lines and then under high tension wires, desperately trying to avoid smashing into her neighborhood. He was able to angle the P-80 toward a nearby vacant lot. Now just 30 feet above the ground, an explosion shook Zane's neighborhood. She watched Bong jump out, holding both hands above his head. The last thing she saw was smoke sweeping over him. An investigation determined he had jettisoned his canopy and pulled the ripcord of his parachute, but he was far too low and it was far too late to save him. He did make it to the vacant lot. No one else was hurt from the crash. The Air Force ordered all P-80s undergo certain engineering modifications before flight tests resumed. The Shooting Star was grounded for less than a month. A final classified report by the Army Air Force's Office of Flying Safety concludes that a minor explosion in the jet's power plant caused the P-80 to lose power. There was no evidence of pilot error. Richard Bong was killed instantly when he struck the ground. Marjorie Bong seldom talked about hearing the news about her husband's death. But from the Bong video documentary, The Boy from Poplar, she said she remained bitter about how the word got out.
On that day, I was on the rooftop on this apartment, and I came down and heard this news on the radio. It seems today, you know, that when tragic news of this kind happens, they don't release the name, you know, pending next of kin notification. That didn't happen. I mean, it was just blatant there on the radio. And the Bong family heard about it the same way.
For years, she didn't talk about it. Bong Center Director Christabel Grant said she not only stopped talking to radio reporters, but she couldn't remember flying home from California to Superior for the funeral in the same church in which they were married just 6 months before. She told her she didn't remember any of those 3 days, not even the day they buried her husband at a cemetery near the Bong family farm. For 40 years, Marjorie Bong stayed away from Superior, never visiting. She returned to California, remarried, raised 2 beautiful daughters, and had a successful career in modeling and then publishing The Boxer Review, a magazine devoted to canines. She finally returned after her husband, Murray Drucker, passed away. Grant said she came back in 1985 for the christening of the mile-and-a-half-long bridge connecting Duluth and Superior, the Richard Ira Bong Memorial Bridge. In 1992, Marjorie Bong Drucker was asked to help raise money for a new idea, the Richard Bong World War II Heritage Center, which was first proposed for Poplar, but eventually built in nearby Superior.
This helped her come to terms with it, because I don't think any of us can avoid coming to terms with a great tragedy like that. So I think that working on the Heritage Center helped her start to think about her life with Dick again and examine it. And she was very quickly became a much sought-after keynote speaker around the country.
But even half a century after his death, Grant said it was still difficult for her to talk about that moment.
Just her whole body language tightens when she gets to that point of the presentation. It was just a tremendous shock, and you might say she was traumatized.
Oh, say, can you see by the
On September 4th, 2002, on what would have been his 82nd birthday, the Richard Bong World War II Heritage Center opened on Superior's waterfront to the voices of the University of Wisconsin Barbershop Quartet singing the national anthem. Several hundred people crowded outside the center overlooking Superior Bay and Lake Superior, including VFWs from Poplar, Superior, and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Bong Board Chairman Brigadier General Ray Klosowski invited the crowd of dignitaries, citizens, and most of all, veterans, to tour this new center.
On behalf of the Richard I. Bong World War II Heritage Center Board of Directors, it's my sincere pleasure to welcome you, each of you, to today's ribbon-cutting ceremony. This event will officially open the Bong Heritage Center to the public. Here's the flyover.
The center is built in the shape of an airplane hangar housing a P-38 Lightning fighter plane, which was painstakingly restored by the volunteers from the Air National Guard, complete with a hand-painted picture of his sweetheart and the name Marge on its nose. 80% of the $5 million to build and staff the Bong Heritage Center was raised privately. Its first director, Christabel Grant, said many of the donations came from veterans. Grant says the building gave Marjorie Bong Drucker a part of Richard back to her. A year later, on September 27th, 2003, she passed away. At the Poplar Cemetery, half a mile from the Bong farm, next to a Medal of Honor stone, is a simple marker. It reads Richard Ira Bong, Major, 5th Air Force, September 24th, 1920, to August 6th, 1945, America's Ace of Aces. Joyce and Jerry Bong say people from all over the country still stop by and lay wreaths or leave little P-38 model airplanes at the grave of their brother.
I remember one guy that was a military person. He stopped at our place on his way through Michigan. He told us that every time he came through, he'd stop underneath the plane and just sit there for a while to stop and pay homage.
This is another part of Bong's legacy. Air Force Academy History Department Chairman Colonel Mark Wells says they use him as an example when they teach their cadets about this nation's heritage and values.
He's an exemplar and a role model, somebody who demonstrates the qualities of character, the courage, and the leadership that we all try to emulate.
His family and friends know Dick Bong didn't seek fame or fortune. As far as fortune goes, he made enough money to pay off the mortgage on the family farm for his parents when he was home on leave in 1944. That was enough. Richard Bong's legacy isn't fame. He didn't like being a national hero, but he probably knew that fame was fleeting. Bong's legacy is history, but also it is about his country and the descendants of the people he served at a critical time in the nation's history. Finally, there is the disappearing legacy of his aging comrades from the jungles of New Guinea. Elwood Barton last saw his pilot, Richard Bong, at a war bond rally in Mobile, Alabama. In 2002, he left Alabama to be at the opening of the Bong Heritage Center. He said he wouldn't miss it.
It was important to me. I mean, I still cry. It was an experience, and he's a great hero. And I loved him.
I'm Jim Packard.
Forever Ace, the Richard Bong story, was written and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Mike Simonson and was narrated by Jim Packard. Reporting help was provided by Wisconsin Public Radio reporters Tarina Beatty, Nick Pelletier, Danielle Kading, Chuck Wormbach, and Shemaine Mills. Editing assistance and consultation provided by Dominic P. Papatola and Christabel Grant. Other assistance from Colonel Jeffrey Williams of the Johnson Space Center, U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Gerald Sonny Perkovich, Carl Bong and his book America's Ace of Aces, The Richard Bong Story, The Complete History of World War II by Ann Woodward Miller, Bong Heritage Center Director Robert Furman, Bong Center Board Director Terry Lundberg, Stan Turner, State Senator Bob Jauch, Paul Guggenheimer, Lou Martin, and Masahito Watanabe. Forever Ace is dedicated to the memory of Daniel Simonson and Edward Manthey, fathers who led by example with dignity. I'm Jennifer Simonson. We leave you with this last vignette, a fun remembrance of America's Ace of Aces.
Dick Bong may have been a church choir boy who preferred soft drinks to hard drinks, but the guy was a character. He liked to play. From his early days of training in San Francisco, he'd buzz people and places in his P-38 Lightning. He buzzed San Francisco's Market Street and nearby Oakland, knocking clothes from the line of a miffed housewife. He buzzed Milwaukee, he buzzed downtown Superior, and Duluthian John Hoff remembers when he buzzed the Duluth Harbor and downtown.
And all of a sudden, I see this plane just go zing and emerge from underneath the aerial bridge. And then he was gone again, just like that.
I'm Mike Simonson. Thanks for listening.
Grab your coat.